were hoping that any attention to Medicaid would be accompanied by some effort to address the federal deficit generally.
The Parnell administration is unhappy about a new infusion of funds for Medicaid and teachers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 16th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, remembering the 1978 crash, Senator Stevens survived.
We must have been hit by a wind shear because all of a sudden one wing goes up. The right wing went up, left wing went down.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
President Obama signed into law last week a bill that sends states more than $26 billion for teacher salaries and Medicaid. Alaska's governor requested the Medicaid money, but now says he doesn't like the bill. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Alaska will gain an estimated $80 million for teacher salaries and Medicaid bills. Governor Sean Parnell signed onto a letter with 46 other governors calling for the Medicaid matching funds. But now he says what would be better than this legislation is getting control of the federal deficit. The director of Parnell's Washington office, John Katz.
We were hoping that any attention to Medicaid would be accompanied by some effort to address the federal deficit generally.
Katz says the state agencies are still crunching the numbers to see exactly how much Alaska will get, but at first blush, it looks like $57 million to extend enhanced Medicaid for 6 months and $23 million in education funds that would primarily go to local districts. Katz admits that will help Alaska, even if the governor's not embracing the legislation.
The states can make good use of the Medicaid and education funds in the bill. However, we don't think that this should be the end of the inquiry. Congress has yet to get control of the federal deficit. Also, while the current legislation purports to be revenue neutral, there are offsets in the bill that will be problematic to some states.
Senator Lisa Murkowski agrees that the debt should be tackled and voted with most Republicans against the bill, accusing Democrats of continuing to embrace huge spending bills at a time of record-high federal deficits. She says it does a disservice to states because it postpones the day of reckoning when they'll have to make tough budget decisions. But her Democratic colleague, Senator Mark Begich, says he voted for the bill because it does exactly what the governor's office asked, gives the state some breathing room.
In respect to the governor's desires and requests, I felt it was a good vote, but also making sure it was offset. And that's what we did. Almost every governor in the country asked for us to do something here.
Begich says he also wants to rein in the debt. And despite Republican protests, he says the key to this bill is that it has offsets. That is, instead of adding to the deficit, Democrats say the bill is paid for. Begich says that earned his support.
You know, I have mixed views on the offsets, but most important to me was there had to be offsets. Because early on, if you recall, there were some amendments that I voted no on those because they weren't offset. When we first had this debate early on about trying to bring teachers forward, there was no offsets. It was going to be a deficit driver. And I was not supportive of that.
The bill is being paid for by cutting nearly $12 billion in stimulus money from the food stamp program, which is raising concerns in some quarters, especially among liberals. It also closes a loophole that U.S. companies take advantage of to operate tax-free abroad, and it trims other programs. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office found it would save the feds $1.37 billion over the coming decade. In Alaska, Allison Elgee, an assistant commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, which deals with Medicaid, says the federal money coming north is significant.
It's a big chunk of change.
Elgee points out that Alaska isn't in the dire straits of some other states, but when state officials put together the fiscal year 2011 budget, they assumed Congress would extend some of the stimulus funding. This infusion of cash isn't as much as the state was expecting, but Elgee says they'll make up that difference by tapping the general fund. fund. And she says if no money came through, they'd still manage.
The state of Alaska is fortunate in that we have available general funds that could have been used in place of the federal funds.
The education money is supposed to go toward reinstating laid-off teachers or hiring teachers and aides, while the state education department says it doesn't yet know how the money will be used. Anchorage School District Superintendent Carol Como says the national group, the Education Commission of the States, came out with numbers for Alaska.
They estimated teaching positions created or saved would be about 267. I believe we'd probably get the bulk of that because the way it looks like it's going to be allocated is through either a Title I type formula allocation or just a per pupil distribution. And if that's true, we would get enough to hire some teachers. There's no question about that. And that could allow us to lower class size, probably close to what we had last year.
Como says she hopes the state quickly takes the money and passes it along to districts just in time for the start of school. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The National Transportation Safety Board is continuing its investigation into the crash that killed Senator Stevens and four others last week. Investigators were able to remove most of the airplane from the Miquelon Hills near Dillingham. NTSB spokesman Peter Knudsen.
Well, the on-scene aspect of the investigation is drawing to a close. We expect that our investigators will conclude their documentation sometime later this week. The engine of the aircraft, as well as the fuselage, have been removed from the mountain. So they are now both in Dillingham in an airport hangar, and they are being laid out and documented.
Knudsen confirmed that the preliminary report will be released by next week. He says the full investigation and final report could take up to 12 months to complete. The probable cause is expected to be included in that report. Knudsen says with the investigation winding down, most of the investigators will soon be leaving Bristol Bay.
Sometimes we do come back to an accident scene, or we do revisit the wreckage if we need to do additional documentation, but most likely the last time we'll be on the physical scene of the accident will have already been concluded.
Senator Stevens will lie in repose from 10 a.m. until 8 p.m. tomorrow at All Saints Episcopal Church in downtown Anchorage. A memorial for Stevens will be held Wednesday at 2 p.m. at the Anchorage Baptist Temple. But the Stevens family is recommending Alaskans who want to pay their respects to the late senator attend the visitation on Tuesday, since space will be limited on Wednesday. The Anchorage Baptist Temple says Vice President Joe Biden is planning to speak at the memorial service. Many reports on Ted Stevens' life in the last week have mentioned the crash at Anchorage International Airport in 1978 that took the life of his first wife, Anne. For insight into how that event impacted Stevens, APRN's Dave Donaldson spoke to another man who was on that plane.
Five people were killed that day in December of 1978, but Ted Stevens was one of two survivors. The other was Tony Motley, a friend of Stevens since 1967, when Stevens had been majority leader of the State House of Representatives, and Motley worked for the commanding general of the Alaskan Command. Motley later served as Commissioner of Commerce during Jay Hammond's first term. He also worked alongside Stevens on getting ANILCA through Congress. They remained friends through Ted Stevens' career in the U.S. Senate and Motley's years as U.S. Ambassador to Brazil and then Assistant Secretary of State. He says the memories of that crash remained with them both.
You know, that had a huge impact on his life, obviously. Losing his wife is, you know, something most of us can't fathom. And so it's no doubt it had an effect on him. But I wouldn't say that it didn't affect him in a negative way, I don't think. I mean, I don't think he was morose. I think, if anything, it may affect him in a positive way.
As one effect, Motley cites a sharper focus that Stevens developed for aviation safety. Stevens was already a pilot and already interested in safety, but as a senator, he found he could do something about the issue, and he did. Except for the years that Motley was overseas, he and Stevens had lunch together, just the two of them, on the anniversary of the crash. He calls it their ritual.
Just an ordinary lunch and, you know, have small talk and gossip about the local politics at the time and It was a pleasant. Wasn't maudlin at all. It was, you know, just a kind of a pleasant encounter. We're both glad to be alive.
Seven people were on that Learjet returning to Anchorage from Juneau, where they'd just attended Jay Hammond's second inauguration. Motley said there was no indication of any problem as the plane was landing. Motley was facing backward and could see the stripes on the runway. That's how close they were to safety.
We must have been hit by a wind shear, because all of a sudden one wing goes up. The right wing went up, left wing went down. Gust of wind. In the process of straightening the wings out, the left edge of the wing hit the runway, but it didn't arrest the path of flight, if you know what I mean. The airplane kept going forward. It didn't skew it. And the pilot then at that point elected to put the power to it and go around. And he had what is known as a power-on stall, which there's only one result from that is the airplane will snap one way or the other, left or right, depending on the make of the airplane. But that's the only thing it'll do. It flipped. And it landed between the runways in snow. The first impact took the tail and the engines off, and then it took one wing off and then the other wing and just slid under the snow upside down.
Motley awoke in the dark airplane. He and Stevens were hospitalized, Motley in intensive care, Stevens with a concussion and other injuries. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a jump for salmon prices on the Kuskokwim.
It's getting me out there fishing, and I'm requesting leave to get out there and make as many openings as I can.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Nearly half the nation's surface water is located in Alaska. That's more than 3 million lakes and ponds, 700,000 plus miles of rivers and streams, and 44,000 miles of coastline. And 99.9% of it meets national water quality standards. That's according to this year's Integrated Water Quality Monitoring and Assessment Report, which the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation provides to the EPA every 2 years. Jacqueline Estes from member station KMBA has more.
Environmental Program Specialist Tim Stevens with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says Alaska has the fewest impaired water bodies in the nation, and land managers are working to make that number even smaller.
We are improving. This year we took, I believe, 11 waters off our impaired water body list.
The state works with landowners and managers, municipalities, and other agencies to develop plans to improve water quality at listed sites, many of which are popular or well-known. Hydrocarbons pollute parts of Big Lake near Wasilla and Dutch Harbor in the Aleutians. Part of the Matanuska River near Palmer is polluted with residue and debris from a landfill. The Chena River has high sediments from urban runoff in Fairbanks. Others listed as not meeting water quality standards are more remote, such as the Red Devil Creek, which is contaminated from mining activities and feeds into the Kuskokwim River. Other water bodies have been damaged by residue from seafood processing, contaminated military sites, the timber industry, as well as urban development. Stephen says the Anchorage water bodies that don't meet standards have one thing in common.
Ship Creek is listed, Campbell Creek is listed, Little Campbell Creek. As far as lakes, we had Jewel Lake got delisted this year. It was on the list. Lakes Hood and Spinard were listed. Some of our smaller streams like Little Rabbit Creek, Little Survival Creek, Furrow Creek are listed for fecal coliform as well. They were all listed for fecal coliform bacteria, with the exception of Ship Creek, which is also listed for petroleum.
Fecal coliform is associated with germs that cause salmonella and other gastrointestinal infections and hepatitis A. When high counts of fecal coliform show up, managers look for failed septic tanks, people without access to sanitary facilities, concentrations of wildlife such as geese, and pet waste. To be sure of the source, watershed hydrologist Mel Langdon of the municipality of Anchorage says DNA tests are needed.
You have to take a lot of samples to be statistically valid in that, and those the analysis aren't cheap. So I'm not sure how extensively that's been done anywhere, and I don't believe it's been done in Alaska yet.
Stevens, however, is sure enough that pet waste is part of the problem that he recommends that pet owners take steps to help improve water quality.
I would encourage pet owners to make sure that they scoop the poop, pick up after their pets, not only when they take them for a walk in the parks, but at home in the backyard, because that can also drain off and get into our creeks as well, the pollutants from their fecal material.
Langdon says the municipality was successful in getting Jewel, Cheney, Hood, and Spinard Lakes into less impaired categories on the list through a Scoop the Poop campaign and other steps. The Kenai River was another success story. Stevens says several agencies worked together to reduce hydrocarbons in the Kenai River by helping boaters replace polluting engines.
And the Kenaitse Indian Tribe, through an EPA grant, had a buyback program where they would purchase, give you a coupon towards the purchase of a new engine if you traded in your older two-stroke engine. So that was an incentive program that helped those people that said really couldn't afford to get a to give up their two-stroke to buy a new four-stroke. It gave them that little incentive to do that.
Stevens also encourages homeowners to avoid using too much fertilizer to avoid runoff into creeks and streams. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Commercial fishermen on the Kuskokwim River are getting prices not seen since farmed salmon took over the market. For the last decade, there's been just one fish buyer on the river, but this year, a new outfit has set up operation. The competition has been a boon to fishermen. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
It's been a long time since salmon prices jumped on the Kuskokwim, and this year they've jumped leaps and bounds. Local fish buyers are offering commercial fishermen a 1,900% increase on chums from last year, up from 15 cents a pound to now $3 a pound. For commercial fisherman Daryl Garrison, the prices are enough to lure him out of his 9-to-5 for the fish openings.
I hadn't done that in a couple years. I was only going when fishing periods were outside of my work hours. Now it's getting me out there fishing, and I'm requesting leave to get out there and make as many openings as I can.
Increases have been across the board. King sold for 17 cents a pound last year. This year they kept going up before reaching $3 a pound. And same for sockeyes. The increases could be attributed to better processing. Also, supply of wild Alaska salmon is down, demands are going up. But many fishermen, like Garrison, say the emergence of a second buyer is making the Kuskokwim catch a lot more valuable.
The competition does definitely help.
This year, two Bethel businessmen started Kuskokwim Seafoods. The small company only buys Kuskokwim salmon from local fishers in Bethel and some nearby villages. Stuart Curry manages the new processor.
The way that we plan to be able to compete was by just having very minimal costs, from administrative costs, salaries, etc., to asset costs.
Kuskokwim Seafoods processes above the seawall from Coastal Villages Seafoods. CVS, as it's called, is part of a community development quota. They're a multi-million dollar organization with sales in other seafoods like pollock, halibut, and cod. When the first opener was called in June, CVS raised their prices. Kuskokwim Seafoods match, starting a price war. Again, Stuart Curry.
This is just what happens when you have competition, and both processors would like to have the maximum amount of volume that they can get.
CVS bumped their prices up again and then again. Each time, Kuskokwim Seafoods stuck with them. But Curry says he's now risking a profit.
We're getting very close to, or actually probably beyond, what makes for a good profitable season for us. We can't even sell dressed chum salmon in Anchorage for more than about $1.75 right now.
Curry took the message public last week. During a call-in show, he questioned the motives behind CVS's new pricing.
I'm starting to wonder if the motive is that there's that certain people only want one processor on the Kuskokwim.
CVS did not respond to calls for this story. Adding to the inter-river competition this season has been a poor run of silver salmon. Cohos are typically more than abundant enough for a modest commercial catch. Chuck Brazil is the Kuskokwim area biologist for Alaska Fish and Game.
We achieved chum and sockeye escapement goals, but now show some of the lowest coho passages on record.
Fish and Game looked at results from recent commercial openings and from a test fishery just above Bethel.
They're the second lowest since 2000 and are less than half than the recent 10-year average for this date as well.
The bigger company, CVS, can weather a slow year or two, or several. They've told local fishermen they lose about $1 to $2 million a year on Kuskokwim area salmon. But for Kuskokwim Seafoods, operating in the red is not an option. Curry is hoping that local fishers will consider more than just pricing when they decide who to sell to.
We wouldn't be able to sustain that for very long. If you look at history, it would probably be a situation where it would revert back to what it has been for the last 10 years, and that's lower prices and less opportunity.
That message resonates with Garrison, who's been commercial fishing since he was 4 years old. He says before this year, his fishing trips barely paid for themselves.
You only get a couple hundred pounds of fish, and you sometimes don't even break even as far as the gas and stuff and the food that you go out, and then so you're basically working for free.
Despite the prices Garrison is enjoying, he's gotten fewer opportunities and smaller harvests during this poor run. But he says he and many other fishermen are doing what they can to ensure there's a second buyer next year.
When I'm selling, you could see a line of a dozen boats before the opening even ends over at Kuskokwim Seafood. So the loyalty to Kuskokwim Seafoods, I think, is playing a big part.
Kuskokwim Seafood says they will be processing next year, and all parties are hoping there's still time for the silver run to pick up. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Last week, the Coast Guard demolished the tallest structure on Attu Island, a 625-foot Loran Tower, which stands for Long Range Aids to Navigation, was brought down on Wednesday. Its Russian-American signal was turned off on August 1st, and the station will be decommissioned on August 26th. When the Coast Guard decommissions the station on the 26th, Alaska's westernmost island will be left uninhabited. The military first manned a Loran station on the island during World War II, and that tower had been in use for 50 years. But last year, the federal government described the system as outdated and calculated it could save $36 million a year by disbanding it. Chief Petty Officer Dana Warr says that the Coast Guard agreed with that assessment.
The technology is outdated. It's an antiquated system. The new, not new, but GPS system is being used much more. And the Coast Guard didn't really have any use for the Loran signal. So it was determined that all the Loran stations across the United States would be shut down.
In February, the Coast Guard turned off the domestic signal at six of Alaska's stations, including Attu. The Port Clarence Loran Tower, which was then Alaska's tallest structure, was demolished in April. Alaska health officials still classify two recent deaths in southeast Alaska as paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, cases. But recent autopsy results point to another cause of death in at least one of the victims. For member station KHNS, Tara Bicknell has more.
57-year-old Mike Saunders died at his home in Haines in late June, a day after being released from Juneau's Bartlett Regional Hospital. Doctors said he showed symptoms consistent with paralytic shellfish poisoning, like numbness and tingling, after eating crab caught near Haines. The poisoning is caused by toxins concentrated in bivalve shellfish like geoducks, oysters, snails, scallops, clams, and mussels. But it's more uncommon to experience PSP symptoms after eating crab. At the time, both Mike and his wife Kate had doubts about the clinical diagnosis. Months later, Kate received the autopsy results that indicated a different cause of death.
They say in the autopsy that it revealed the cause of death to be severe coronary artery atherosclerosis, in other words, heart disease.
The medical examiner's office wrote that the urine test for toxins associated with PSP came out negative, but the report further stated that the examiner could not totally exclude poisoning as the cause of death, but that the death was best classified as natural due to heart disease.
He had said that maybe the whole thing initially on that Friday night after eating crab triggered all this other stuff, but at the same time, it didn't really matter what the trigger was because he had shown signs of so many previous heart attacks and damage from them that it was just a matter of time before there's going to be a trigger because 80 to 90% of his heart was damaged.
The Department of Health and Social Services calls that a suspected case of PSP, says spokesman Greg Wilkinson.
With this case, we had the patient showing initial symptoms that are consistent with paralytic shellfish poisoning. We showed that the patient had consumed something that had the possibility of containing PSP. So symptoms, the fact that he ate something that may have contained PSP, that qualifies it as a suspected case of paralytic shellfish poisoning.
The week before Saunders' death, a woman in Juneau died of cardiopulmonary arrest at Bartlett Regional Hospital after showing symptoms associated with PSP. She had eaten cockles gathered in Auk Bay that later tested positive for dangerous levels of the poisonous toxins. Alternatively, crab tested near the area where Saunders' crab came from showed harmless levels of PSP. Wilkinson says because of those results in Juneau, the woman's case was classified as a confirmed PSP case.
We define our cases in one of three ways, either suspected, as probable, or as confirmed.
Meanwhile, Kate Saunders says having more clarification about her husband's death is comforting.
Oh, it's relief that there's so many people that were feeling horrible about this because they felt some responsibility to have that burden lifted from it. It's a great relief.
Reporting in Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Fairbanks set a new high temperature record yesterday. National Weather Service meteorologist Matthew Kidwell says the 91-degree reading was more than just a new high for the date.
It's the warmest temperature recorded in Fairbanks this late in August in the historical records for 100 years.
The heat wave, which is affecting the West Coast all the way to Alaska, is the result of a high-pressure ridge that's funneling in warm air. Kidwell says conditions are forecast to moderate over the next day. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Adam Cade in Dillingham, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Tara Bicknell in Haines, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.